afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of House Finance to order. It is about 1:05 on Tuesday, November 7th at, and here we are in Juneau after a long night. So present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, down on the list here, Representative Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Grand, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton. And before we start, remind everybody about their cell phones. And Vice Chair Guerra will be joining us shortly. I want to recognize that we have Speaker Edgman in the audience with us. We have Representative Sadler and Representative Talrico. Today we are going to go back looking at our other item on the call. And for background on that, we have Director of the Office of the Managing Budget, Pat Pitney. And if you'd go ahead and come forward. And so we're going to look at budget gap analysis and fund source balances so that we know where we are, so we can see where we are going. And would you go ahead and put yourself on the record and proceed?
For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm the director for the Office of Management and Budget. Thank you for having me, and hopefully you had some rest overnight. We're just trying to kind of put the current status out as we know it. This is not the governor's budget. This is the known issues that we're facing today. This is just looking at what we had in terms of the budget last year and if we were going to fund that same level of services this year. So this in no way represents the governor's budget that will be submitted in December. So this current year that we're working in is fiscal year 18, and the total state budget is $10.2 billion. That includes federal funds, other funds, designated general funds, and general funds. And we are reporting that the dividend is part of the unrestricted general funds, as we anticipate using the earnings reserve going forward as one of the primary sources for the unrestricted general funds. So of that $10.2 billion, half is unrestricted general funds. Of the unrestricted general funds, you can see the breakout of where those funding sources go. Education is the largest. Second largest is permanent fund dividend. Medicaid, other health programs. Then you see public safety and justice budget items. That statewide budget item is like debt service and the like. And then you can see much smaller budgets make it up. Of this unrestricted general funds, half of it is sent directly out of the state treasury for payments either to communities, providers, oil companies, or individuals. So 50% of that unrestricted general funds goes out as payments for things like Medicaid to providers on behalf of enrollees, money to schools, retirement payments on behalf of communities and schools, debt reimbursement to communities who've built schools, payments to individuals through senior benefits, public assistance, foster care funding, et cetera. And then oil and gas tax credits, and of course a large one of permanent fund dividends. So that leaves only the other half of that unrestricted general fund to fund what people term government services.
Pitney, can you just say the slide number as you go forward in case
Thank you.
People are following our audio and they have been able to download on the website. So make sure they
Thank you. So I'm now turned to page 5. This is a rolled up version of the unrestricted general fund spending trend fiscal year 15 to fiscal year 18. And if you look at the total operating budget has gone down 23% in that time period, total budget down 28%. But I want to bring your attention to education in the university down 8%, health and safety budgets down 9%, Medicaid and health formulas down 20%, other executive departments, so that's the governor's office, DNR, fish and game, transportation, down 43% in unrestricted general fund. Then debt service and retirement and oil and gas tax credits down 50%, and legislature and courts down 11%. For a total operating decrease of 23%, then you add in the capital decrease of 78% for over this course of this administration, 28% decrease with significant help from the legislature. People ask about the unrestricted general fund with the designated general fund. When you add in the designated general fund, the operating cut goes down to 16%, and the total budget reduction is 23% over that time period. Oftentimes people ask, well, did you just replace the budget? And either way you slice it, there's significant reductions.
Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how about federal funds, though? There's no way for us to know whether or not they increased or decreased during this time.
So not from this particular slide, but that is certainly available information, and federal funds have increased during that time period.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson, follow-up.
Right, and maybe in a follow-up email, I tried to look at the other information that you gave us that had the designation numbers from 2015 to 2017, and like health and safety departments, I'm not exactly sure what all is included in those numbers, because even when I did education and university, my numbers came out different than the numbers they have here. So there may be other things that you're including, but as I try to take these numbers with the charts that are in another attachment that you had, mine came out, like in education and university was a $100 million difference. So I don't know whether or not there's other numbers in there I'm not including, but if we could get maybe more details sent to the co-chair so we can match them all up, that would be helpful.
Certainly can do that, and we've also included backgrounds. Yeah.
And those numbers are the ones I was choosing, Mr. Chairman, and I did the education university, and my numbers just didn't come out the same way. So there may be maybe debt service or other things that are included in there that I just don't know because it's generalized. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and the director will follow up, and so we can distribute that to the whole committee.
Yep.
Right. That's what I asked to you, the co-chair. Thank you.
And before you go forward, I wanted to recognize we've also been joined by Representative Stutes and Representative Knopf. Thank you.
So moving on to page 7, this is kind of reconciling what legislative finance provided earlier during the special session and what OMB views are known increases. So at the top of the list is Medicaid. And we are expecting in the range of $75 million in additional payments based on where we were in fiscal year 17, where we closed out fiscal year 17. Legislative Finance had a figure of $32 million, and when we were closing out the fiscal year 18 budget, or when we proposed our fiscal year 18 budget, we communicated we thought we were low by about $32 million. It turns out it's going to be closer to $75 million low for fiscal year 18. The next item down, the Marine Highway System, there was Ledge Finance communicated a $40 million reduction. That was a supplemental put in to the Marine Highway Fund from prior year funds, and then a larger draw of the Marine Highway funds. There was also another $4 million extra draw, so our figure there is $44 million to just to do a status quo service level on Marine Highway. Fire suppression, we did not put this in our forecast, but $15 million is not an unreasonable expectation. I would say I would tend to say it's going to be closer to 7.5, given the balance that they had from last year. Salary and benefits, we don't feel it's going to be $15 million, but we don't have exact figures yet. We do not anticipate a increase for the employer contribution for Alaska Care. There are a couple union contracts that require increase to health employer health benefits, but I would say that that's much lower than 15, but I would say in the range of 5, but that's not a known increase at this point.
And, you said you are not anticipating anything for Alaska Care. Later in the week, we'll get something else from the health authority, but mm-hmm. I believe the Foster study said that the average escalation was 7.5% over the last 10 years. So is this saying that you're anticipating zero health care cost escalation in the coming year?
We do not anticipate an increase to the Alaska Care employer benefits, so the 1555, which is the employer contribution that exists today. We expect that to extend through 19. There will be increases in the employee contribution to the premium, and we are seeing improved performance of our steerage. There were several initiatives to help reduce our employer healthcare or employee healthcare costs, and many of those are beginning to bend the curve the way we had hoped that they did. But there will be an increase in employee contributions.
Fine. And when we later in the week talk about healthcare costs as a driver in our budget, we might ask you to come back and just so that we can coordinate those two different messages. If the increase in cost is going down, where is it getting paid, or is it less service, or is, you know what that is? So at that time, but I just want to let you know that we'd like you to come back.
And these are very. These are very short-term cost changes, so this isn't looking forward. And I do agree with Mark Foster's 7% for employee health care increases over the last 10 years, and I think Medicaid over that same time period is just short of 5 over that last 10 years on the state funding side. If you include both, you're back up to that 7. Mm-hmm.
Representative Guerra, and I do want to recognize that Guerra did join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, two questions on salary and benefits. As the state started running out of money, there were negotiations with the employee unions, and as I recall, they agreed to 2 years of no cost of living increases. For FY18, is that still a year of no cost of living increases, or is that a year where the third year with the cost of living increase finally jumps in?
It through the chair, Representative Garrett, depends on the contract and which one is which. Several of them are in the zero cost of living increase. The PSEA contract, which was just finalized, does have an increase. The corrections union, their last increase was this fiscal year.
So, largest unions through the chair, those are still in.
Those are most all of them are without cost of living increases, but we can get a full list.
most of them for FY18. Mm-hmm. Still no cost of living increase next year, but that's going to start. And that's mm-hmm. the last year of it, right?
Right.
Lastly, I don't mean to put you on the spot by this. So obviously somebody's got to take the lead on this issue of healthcare costs, and we'll have a hearing on that. And I know we saw the studies that came out from Mark Foster, and they were on narrow issues, combining healthcare plans and things like that. Was OMB going to take the lead at some point on a sort of healthcare cost reduction effort? And as I recall, OMB was going to. I know a lot of things happened this summer. And so where are we on that?
So through the chair, Representative Guerra, we are meeting internally with Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Administration, and Commerce and Economic Development. All three are working in separate areas, and OMB is taking kind of an umbrella view of how do we coordinate all of those efforts and be able to move in a very similar, at least make sure the right hand and the left hand know how we're moving, and making sure that a particular initiative in one area doesn't counteract a desire to move in another area. So we are actively meeting together to say, how can we, as an entire organization, address health care costs? And we, within the budget, it's about one point initial analysis is about $1.2 billion goes through the state budget on the state side for Medicaid, employee health care costs, retiree on behalf payments, the amount of benefits charged within our retirement contribution, how much of that goes to health care, how much health care is in corrections, how much health care is associated with juvenile justice, how much health care is associated with, you know, the recent federal waiver in our private insurance market. That's about $1.2 billion. If that continues to grow at 5% versus an inflation-only forecast, in a few short years, that's a $200 million difference in our budget. So those are just initial overview cost pieces.
Representative Guerra and then Ortiz.
Thank you. I only ask this because I'm probably going to have to miss a hearing or two this week to run back to Anchorage for
a little closer to the mic.
I only ask this question because I may miss the healthcare presentation. I got to run back to Anchorage for a very non-serious doctor's thing. But can we expect that the administration is going to have sort of an initiative that we'll see by the beginning of session, or that would be sort of. We have two staff members mostly in most of our offices. I guess we could all do that, but if we're going to see something from the administration that relieves us of that would be useful for me. Are we going to see some sort of major initiative from the administration on healthcare cost containment come January?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we will be continuing to focus on initiatives that reduce cost. I'm not prepared to say that it will be viewed as major. We will continue to be working on costs. I think it is a big enough issue that there's going to be a lot of ideas out there. We all know it's the biggest cost driver that we'll be facing, but the solutions aren't simple, and any solution affects everybody. So we will be continuing to focus on healthcare costs and what we can do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And before we go to Representative Ortiz, I wanted to recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins joined us, Representative Quito, and I think I recognize Representative Talrico, but if I didn't, he's been here from the beginning. So thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
Pat, going back up to the AMHS line, the Las Marine Highway line, the $44 million. That money was what you say was the total amount of drawdown from the Marine Highway Operating Fund. Is that the right term?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I don't know the exact. It's the Marine Highway Fund, Alaska Marine Highway Fund. I don't know the exact words for it, but it's the Marine Highway Operating Fund. It's where the revenues from the fares are deposited.
And do you know after that $44 million drawdown, how much there is in that fund at this point?
Well, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there is an issue that in the compromise for the budget, for the operating budget last year, there was a deposit intended to be $40 million in the fiscal year 17 budget. That deposit, because of the CBR cap and because of higher than expected other supplementals, that deposit it was supposed to be $30 million, and it turned out to only be $23 million. So that if we don't replenish that intended $23 million, which we do intend to submit a supplemental for, if that's not replaced, then that fund would be completely exhausted in as early as April.
And as a follow-up, could you give me a brief summary as to how that fund, when there was money in it, was used for how it was used by the Marine Highway System in terms of going from year to year to year? Was it like a buffer fund, that kind of a thing?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it was used as an operating fund, but it only funded partial service. So roughly 35 to 40% of money for the highway, Marine Highway, is through fares. The remaining part of the cost is general fund. Both fund sources were used to fund the operation of the Marine Highway System. By having the fund from the fares, there was some certainty on cash flow, and there was, to the extent, a buffer in that if the legislature chose, they could appropriate additional money, in a year that was necessary. Under this scenario, there would not be that operating flexibility. It's not so much flexibility because the legislature still has to appropriate the funds, but there's not the cash that exists.
Follow up. So with that in mind, if you were to go back like on your slide 6 and put transportation and then the Marine Highway System within transportation on that look back between 2015 to 2018, do you have an idea how much there was a reduction in transportation, and then how much of a reduction as a part of that reduction in transportation was felt by the Marine Highway System? Does that make sense, my question?
Through the chair, your question made perfect sense. It is not one I can answer off the top of my head, but it's transportation has a significant reduction.
And would you say that the Marine Highway System
also
had a bigger
significant reduction
as part of that transportation reduction?
Both have had a significant reduction.
Thank you.
And before we go on further, Representative Pruitt has joined us as well. And I didn't see any more. That's great.
Okay. So in the Department of Corrections inmate health care, we requested, as part of the Medicaid reform effort, there was an expectation of lower inmate health care costs. In fact, Medicaid did pick up a significant amount of inmate health care costs, but we did not receive as much reduction as we anticipated just due to the cost increases in health care. And so last year there was a supplemental request for $10 million if we managed in 18 to have that same amount, it'll be another $10 million. to cover health care costs because that was not part of the 18 bays.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on this issue, it's my understanding that there's been at least a couple, if not three, inmates that have gone to the lower 48 because of health costs and the affordability of it. I'm going to the lower 48. In fact, one of them, my understanding, is up to $500,000 of savings. So why is corrections not utilizing halfway houses and electronic monitoring for some of our higher costs where we know Medicaid expansion will pick those up, but they won't pick them up if they're still in the institution?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think that there's been a case-by-case look at every option, and they view it in respect with public safety as well as with cost.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
I believe, I can't remember if it was this session or last session, we actually received information on what those illnesses were. And I guess my point is that, you know, if you had to turn a halfway house into more of a medical-type facility so that we would be able to utilize, and not just Medicaid expansion, their personal insurance would even pay, you know, if you had somebody who had private insurance, would also pick up, which it doesn't in the institution. Has that ever been looked at as an option?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know for sure if we've looked at an inmate health care facility separate from a prison.
And, Mr. Chairman, my point is...
Representative Wilson,
thank you. And
I think we probably ought to get corrections in here to find out whether the halfway house is or is not.
It is. We received information on that in Medicaid expansion will on halfway houses as well as electronic monitoring. But I guess, it, you know, back to having the discussion on health, I would hope that could be, you know, added to that because that decision's only been a year. It's not been a long decision as far as Medicaid expansion goes. But I guess I just find it hard that if I have, you know, to have, you know, dialysis for kidney and I'm getting it paid for, I doubt seriously I'm probably going to run off and not be able to get that treatment. So I think that has to be part of the health care. But as we're rewriting those contracts, now would be the time, I think, not just for mental health issues, but also into these kind of health issues, especially if our only other option is going to be sending some of our patients who are very ill out of state and away from families. Is there another avenue that we might be able to have and still have the savings? Thank you.
And thank you for that. And we will be talking about that here and saving this. And so we will add that to the
document. Add it in there.
Good. Director Pitney, did we have a question over here? No.
Okay. So the next one is actually just a difference between fund source. This was the Mount Edgecombe facility funding was changed to be on the public school trust fund. So Ledge Finance has that as an increase on unrestricted general fund. That fund source is available this year as well. It was not one that it's being funded. The fund source is available in future years. So the next two items, I'm not exactly sure why we put the known increases as decreases above the line, but these two items, the first one is we expect debt service to be reduced by $4 million. That's just what our debt service payments are. It's just what we owe, and it's coming down. The community assistance program at the end of last session, $8 million was appropriated on top of the amount that comes out of the community assistance fund. That was a one-time item, so that we see that as some relief in the budget going forward. Because of the change in the oil price and production forecast, the oil and gas tax credits is expected to increase by $118 million over last year. The public education fund was used. We used a one-time reappropriation from the UMN Road District. That $17 million has to be replaced with probably ongoing revenue. And then the state assistance to retirement, the actuarial increase is $107 million. So all told on the increases, OMB expects on the operating side is $360 compared to the Ledge Finance, $347. And, you know, we're pretty close relative to to budgeting terms, and we know the differences. The capital budget, $93 million, represents the amount of reappropriations that were done in the capital budget last year. So the reappropriations are prior year's dollars, so they don't add to the bottom line total, but effectively funded $93 million more in projects. So if we had the same capital budget we did last year, you can add $93 million. And then fiscal notes, program sunsets and other one-time items have a relief of $65 million. Some of those will materialize and some will not. Some of them are on justice reform. So, and then, so you get all told, now you're at about $388 million in known changes, known increases just to fund the service level of last year.
So you still have, and I understand you still have an austerity capital budget, the $93 million. I think the average mm-hmm. before the fiscal crisis was somewhere in the range of $500-600 million mm-hmm. a year. Would the governor, and there no secret, there are varying views in this building about a fiscal plan and what it should look mm-hmm. like, and we all know each other's positions. Would the governor, what I'm concerned about is the governor proposes a $93 million sort of austerity capital budget. We're just going to continue the slide in construction jobs, continue the deferred maintenance that's going to damage buildings even worse and structures even worse. Would the governor consider proposing a capital budget that meets the needs out there with the understanding that he's going to have to veto it if the legislature can't come together on a fiscal plan, like do it the other way around on the capital budget?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I will not make any presumption on what the governor is choosing or will choose to do on this year's capital budget. We'll know that in December. But for this $93 million, we had $132 million capital budget. This $93 million was on top of that. It was done through reappropriations, and that's not even counting the Juneau Access Road reappropriation, but all other reappropriations that actually went to other projects. So the spending was $132 million plus $93 million in the capital budget because of being able to go back to projects that either weren't being done or were a lesser priority that were moved to it. So the effective capital budget that we had last year was over $220
million. Right.
And so that's why it's a $93 million on top of the $132, so it's really closer to it. Last year's, to have the same capital budget of last year would be over $225 million.
Thank you.
So basically, this is just indicating that those are one-time funds. They're used up now.
Right.
Okay, thank you. So if we wanted to fund this next year's budget, those one-time funds were used. They're not available, so the $93 million would be have to come from some other source. Okay. Are there any other questions?
I'm moving now on to page 8. So based on the budget change of $388 million on page 7, you add that to our fiscal year 18 $4.3 billion budget. Now you're up to a $4.7 billion budget. This is without the permanent fund dividend. This is just what people term as government. So you have 4.7 would be the base in 19. You have revenue in the new revenue forecast of just over $2 billion. That leaves a deficit of $2.7 billion. If you look at the Senate Permanent Fund Plan, which has a 75% government, 25% dividend split, versus the House's plan, which has a 33% dividend and a 67% to offset government's costs, just short of $1.9 billion. Okay, so it leaves a gap between $600 and $800 million steady state. Now, you have fiscal year 19, fiscal year 20, and fiscal year 21. The differences there on spending is just a known increases for retirement and debt and credits, and otherwise just increasing at inflation only. So.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat, for being here. I handed out a 20-year look back on the capital budget. It's a big sheet with lots of tiny numbers. It had to be on an 11 by 17 sheet. And what Representative Guerra was talking about on the budget, can you just tell me first, is the budget maintaining flat level services, does that include the capital budget, the GF that goes into the capital budget?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it represents, I need to look back and double check my number, but I believe it's $225 million on capital. Steady state going forward with inflation.
Okay, so 225 going into the future until unknown time, I guess.
Yeah. And we'll take just a brief at ease while people look at the spreadsheet.
So through the chair, Ms. Pitney, so basically what you're saying is that the capital budget anticipated, if you look at this graph, which is 1998 final to last year's budget, going forward would be 225, would be the unrestricted and designated general funds would be 225.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes.
Through the chair. This is just more editorializing because you can look at the numbers and you can see the years where there were bigger capital budgets than others. And, you know, you look at the far right, which is the most recent data, versus the far left, which is the oldest data. Our capital budget is smaller than it's ever been in 20-year history. I guess, you know, when I hear that we have a budget gap of $2.7 billion, I think that's understated, and I know that the Associated General Contractors are meeting tomorrow and for a week-long conference or a few-day conference to sort of discuss the capital budget, but can you tell us some unanticipated costs that would reflect in budgets in the future if we have an austere $225 million budget going forward?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, can you elaborate on that question, please?
Well, we know that we've got about $1 billion in deferred maintenance at the University of Alaska statewide system, or statewide. We have another $1 billion in state infrastructure in deferred maintenance, and that doesn't include local communities that have their own schools and boroughs and things like that. So I guess what is the risk of having a capital budget that is fixed at 225 in next year for 10 years?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it covers virtually federal match and minimum deferred maintenance. It does not cover any new facilities. And again, this is a representation. The forecast here is a representation of the fiscal year 18 service level. Does not represent the governor's intention or a plan going forward. Just if we just moved what we did in fiscal year 18 forward, this is what it would look like.
So through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that does not include any deferred maintenance. It only includes capturing what the federal match might be.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it's federal match and minimum deferred maintenance. So federal match Federal match gets you just over about $120 million. Then you have other programs that are funded through the capital budget traditionally, and it leaves a very small amount for deferred maintenance overall.
I guess...
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very sensitive to the capital budget, just being, just having watched it wax and wane. And I guess we say that we have a $2.7 billion budget deficit on paper. I think it's actually larger. I'm just looking at the numbers from the previous 20 years when we've had capital budgets that have been substantially larger, and that barely got us to the deferred maintenance level. And we have a $2 billion deferred maintenance. We have $2 billion in deferred maintenance today, mm-hmm. meaning we really didn't keep up with our deferred maintenance needs for, several years, and we've had capital budgets that were much, much larger. I think it's just an understated scenario when you look at what our current deficit really is and what our future deficit is going to look like. I hope that the administration and legislators recognize that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when you're looking at the Senate Permanent Fund Plan or the House Permanent Fund Plan, are you looking at having a 6.5% annual return, which was another handout that we have?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this particular base scenario was built on 6.95% return. 6.5% return was information we got just shortly after we put this together. And so the 6.5% return means about $100 million 4 to 5 years out, $100 million difference in both the Senate plan and the House plan 4 to 5 years out. So really, in this short, the 19 to 21 period, really doesn't make a lot of difference because it's on a lagging five-year average. So going forward, though, you'd see about a revenue shortfall on both the House and Senate plan of about $100 million.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So I guess what I'm missing, though, is what data do you have that lowers it from the 6.95% annual return to the 6.5%?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the scenario spreadsheets that are coming up have the 6.5 built in.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
I understand that, but I'm trying to find out why we were at 6.95%. I'm assuming there was data that gave us a 6.9. I just don't know what data changed, mm-hmm. you know, since we've seen the rise in the stock market, all that seems to be mm-hmm. still going at a certain, you know, rate. So why now are we using scenarios at 6.5% annual return?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Wilson. Now I understand better your question. The Permanent Fund Corporation has an advisor in its Callan and Associates, and they have not just for the Permanent Fund Corporation, but for other large clients that they advise, have reduced their 10-year outlook from the 6.95 to 6.5, and that was just done recently at an Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation board meeting where that advice came forward.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, can we just get the backup on where the 6.95 came and then a 6.5 so we have a better understanding of what changed their minds on that and what we might be looking even outside of that, because maybe 6.5% is also too high and we don't want to make mistakes in that area when we're looking mm-hmm. at possibly utilizing any of that for government.
Representative Wilson, we're going to have the director of the permanent fund in soon, and you know, Callan Associates are its corporation, and that's their financial advisors, and so I think that she can share, Dr. Odell can share that information directly with us, but I'm not sure that that's under the control of no. Office of Management and Budget, so I just want to give them the out to punt that to the corporation itself that will be presenting to us.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't think they have the graphs. I think it's just a matter of information. I would hope the administration would know it, but I am fine with the Permanent Fund Corporation bringing it, but we could get that maybe before the meeting so we can kind of, you know, analyze it ourselves too so we're ready for questions and not trying to just absorb all of it and ask those types of questions at the same time. But I appreciate that.
And we can see what the what they are willing to share of their internal
memos.
Yeah, well, it's not just their memos. They have an internal relationship with Callan Associates, and whether they can share directly that work product or whether that's a confidential work product between them, and I don't know. We'll put in the request. I'm just putting the caveat that it may not be something that's non-confidential outside of the corporation. So we'll find out.
But, Mr. Chairman, just even knowing the factors that we should be looking at would be helpful. I understand that they might not want to give all their information away, but maybe at a higher view, because we probably don't need that far down into the weeds, but things that we would know to be looking at as we're making these types of decisions along the way.
And we'll put that request in.
Thank you.
Are there further questions at this point? Yes, Representative Gehr.
Just on the difference in the budget gap between the Senate Permanent Fund Plan and the House's Permanent Fund Plan, there's roughly $1,000 for a dividend. Ours roughly $1,250 for a dividend. That $250 difference, as we've looked at over the years, has always looked like for an additional $250 in the dividend, it's about $170-180 million. But you show a difference of $230 million. I know there's probably a different factor that's going on that I'm missing. Can you explain that?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Gehr, it's just as the permanent fund value goes up, the amount from the 5% or the 5.25% lagging average increases, and as that happens, the spread between a 25% dividend and a 33% dividend is a larger amount of money.
Good, Chair.
Representative Gehr.
Yeah, so in shorthand, this year there's a lot more money in the earnings reserve than there was last year, and that's leading to, under those formulas, a larger dividend and a larger difference, or no?
Through the chair, no, because the dividend is based on the draw, and the draw is based on 5.25% over a prior 5-year average. But over time, as the amount grows, the actual net difference in cost for the dividend, instead of being $150 million, grows to 225, 250, 250 million, just because of the difference of the 25% versus a 33% calculation, because the amount drawn is the same amount. I mean, the percentage drawn is the same amount. It's just what the split is.
Thanks.
And Representative Gunberg, and would you pull your mic?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it when others do the same thing. You're just kidding. So, spending on the no federal cost shifts, right? Over the years, the recent years, we've done more and more of doing that. Is it the analysis of OMB that we have pretty much done all we could do? Is there any places or any scenarios that are changing that would allow us to do any more of that?
So, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is... This represents, for the most part, what are more negative consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't meet oil price and production forecasts, that revenue number drops. The gap grows. If we can't keep agency costs at inflation or below, that gap grows. So whatever we do with public safety and corrections and all of that, based on this, then the gap would grow. On the no federal cost shifts, this is if the feds don't shift costs back to the state.
Mm-hmm.
And with the health care uncertainty, that could be a significant move back. But there's other federal programs that that from a policy perspective, we would have to, you know, the legislature would have to contemplate whether they would want to fund them or not fund them. So this assumed that only we were going to get more costs shifted from the federal government to the state. And then on the K-12 increases, again, on average, it was growing closer to 5% for many years, and this is, has only a 2.25% with no student growth built in as a forecast. So to me, all four of those items were items that would push it up. That doesn't even count what Representative Kawasaki had talked about in terms of, but you don't have enough built in for a capital budget at this point.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That got me where I wanted to go. Thank you.
Okay. I move on to page 9. So I pretty much just covered this particular item with the response to Representative Guttenberg. And I'd mentioned the health care cost containment efforts. Right now, this forecast was built in at inflation only at 2.25%. If costs continued, if we can maintain costs at 5% instead of the, you know, 7% quoted, that's a difference of roughly $100 million. And then if you can keep it at 3.5% instead of little over 5%, that's another $100 million. If you can keep your costs increasing at only 2.25%, that's $100 million. So for how much ever healthcare costs rise above 2.25%, that adds to this gap. Then we have the others, you know, criminal justice initiative, you're working on that. So it's very present in your minds right now. The market correction affecting the permanent fund earnings. So we've built in both 6.95 and 6.5% increases. But, you know, if there were an experience that we had from 2007 to 2015, that would be a difference of, you know, almost $500 million from where we're talking about at an average 6.5% draw. The other thing to make sure everybody is aware of, both the House plan and the Senate plan has a very structured draw on the permanent fund, and it's 5.25 on a lagging 5-year average. And then over time, it drops down to 5% on a lagging 5-year average. But that's very structured and was decided on based on what's sustainable for the fund to grow in real terms or to maintain its value in real terms. If the legislature takes $500 million more out of the fund for a period of 5 years, that draw produces $150 million less every year forever. If you take $500 million more per year for 10, you get $400 million a year less from that revenue stream forever. So, and essentially, the overdraw is taking for today what it should be available for generations tomorrow. And it's a big amount of money. When you talk about, let's just go with the over 5 years. So instead of putting in a $320 million, or let's instead of doing $500 million in new revenue, and you just do it for 5 years, just to stay even, now you have to put in a $650 million new revenue amount, because what you're going to get from the permanent fund is $150 million less. So, and overdrawing the earnings reserve in the near term creates a larger gap in time.
And Pat, before you go on the healthcare cost containment efforts, were those looking at agencies, or was that including our unfunded liability to Persian Surge Deposit?
It's viewing all healthcare cost issues. So Medicaid, juvenile justice, corrections, employee health care costs, writ large, everything that passes through the state budget and retirement. And what we pay 22% on every employee in PERS, and in the K-12 school systems, 22% plus it's 12.5% for TERS. So it's the amount of that contribution that is part of the health care. So it's factoring in all of those different pieces. We're at $1.2 billion.
And can you go over again? Was it 1.5% change at $100 million? Was, or what was that factor that you were relating? 5%, 3.5%. What was the
2.25 to 3.5? So it's 1.25 difference is $100 million, 4 years out.
And Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit off base, but it's up there. So every time a governor or the, or a mayor comes in, I say the same thing to them. It's like, disaster planning. You don't want to be the guy gets caught short. So I'm sure it's a disaster planning and preparedness is a across the board departmental effort, but is can you just respond to the question of how is the state's ability to just all of a sudden start shoving out $100 million here, $100 million here? We have assuming that everything else priorities come off, move off the table a little bit, that we have a disaster, or do we have the capabilities of moving money without calling us back in to take care of that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, if we leave a prudent balance in the CBR, which it is at the, it's getting down right now, but if we leave $2 billion in the CBR, then we figure that is sufficient. If you're in a stable fiscal environment, that would be sufficient to address most natural disasters. So I'm moving on to page 10. So again, looking at the various levels of gap. So if going back to the previous slide or slide 8, you can see the 638 and the 863. The under the Senate plan, you have $618 million. Under the House plan, you have $836 million in terms of a gap. If you had a compromised dividend plan, it'd be somewhere in the middle, $700 million. If oil could go up to $65 a barrel, our gap would be $370 million. If oil went down to $50 a barrel and we had the compromise dividend, we'd be at 900. So you can kind of just see the range of gap that you would have under different circumstances, and any one is as valid as the next. And this is just in graphic form over time. So the only one different here is the market crash. If we had the same experience we did from 2007 to 2015, and we used the compromise dividend, you see right here the market crash leaves you between, you know, 700 and 900 million under $50 barrel oil. It just gets worse over time. And this is a compromised dividend over $1 billion. If you have a compromised dividend and revenue in fiscal year 19, 22, and 25, you see this gap reducing over time.
I'm sorry. I might have missed this, but I thought in the explanation a couple slides ago when we were talking about what the budget was with flat service, that number did not include the permanent fund dividend. And then if you take the number and put it on page 10, and show the baseline revenues and the permanent fund earnings, and then you have that budget, but the money or the permanent fund dividend was larger in the House bill than it was in the Senate bill.
Correct. So, and so the gap goes from, sorry, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the gap in the Senate plan is $600 million. The gap in the House plan is $800 million. So you have a larger gap with the House plan because of the dividend difference.
So through the chair, so the first two lines, baseline plus permanent fund minus budget 2019, that's $618 million I didn't do the math, but it looks about right. And then in the second example, it's House Senate Bill 626. But it had a – what I'm saying is it had a higher permanent fund dividend.
So through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, this is the permanent fund earnings draw that would go to cover government. The remaining amount would go to the dividend. So this – This excludes the dividend from the component, but because the dividend is higher in the House plan, the gap is higher.
Further questions?
So, bring your attention to the second bullet. With revenue and with the CBR, you can avoid overdrawing the permanent fund. And the permanent fund needs to be viewed as our primary revenue stream. And a prudent target for revenue should be $600 million. Right now we're looking at $320 million in the tax that's proposed, 4001, and you know, we assume the motor fuels tax will go forward. We'll assume some other smaller fee increases would go through. But really, if we're going to assure going forward a very solid playing field with little risk, $600 million would be a prudent revenue target to meet. So we've kind of gone through this one. A little bit about estate savings. This represents the revenue and expenditures over the last several years. Fortunately, in the time 2010 to 2012, we were building our reserves, but you can see that deficit area between revenue and expense in the last several years. We have consumed the $14 billion, even with a 44% decrease in state unrestricted general fund spending since 2013. Unfortunately, revenues have gone down even more dramatic. We've spent $14 billion from our savings over that time period. And the Constitution does require repayment of the CBR back to its peak of where it was in 2013. Even for both the spending of the CBR and the provision to not sweep the funds requires a three-quarter vote. And so the Constitutional Budget Reserve, in as far as we see it, will be part of the budget discussions from here forward. Even under the best circumstance, I don't think we're going to be able to put $14 billion back into the CBR. So that will be a constant part of all budget discussions going forward. We have been fortunate, though, of having the CBR and having it draw this gap. Unfortunately, at $2 billion, in our mind, that $2 billion is what the prudent level of the CBR should be. And that helps both to address volatility that our state will still have, even if we put the permanent fund plan into play and we have a broad-based revenue, we will still be more volatile than any other state in the nation. Right now we're three times more volatile than the next most volatile state, which is either Wyoming or North Dakota. So having the CBR balance that exists, or very near where it exists, is very prudent. We use about $1 billion from the CBR annually for cash flow. And then if there's anything unexpected that comes up, having the CBR to use rather than having to go to the ad hoc to the earnings reserve is a much better plan, because we know overdrawing the earnings reserve costs us an annual revenue stream, a significant annual revenue stream in the future. So what are some of the other fund balances that exist? We have the power cost equalization fund is at just over $1 billion. It funds the power cost equalization payments of about $40 million. There's also provisions that allow for it to fund community assistance and renewable energy. Higher education fund is $339 million. The asterisk there for both of those is a quasi-endowment, and where at the very bottom, the Italic School Trust Fund is an actual endowment. But they're a quasi-endowment set up by the legislature. Higher Education Fund provides for scholarships, but over the course of the last 3 years, several programs have been put on that. So the WAMI program, the Online with Libraries program, teacher mentor program was funded out of it 1 year. I don't know if it's continuing to be funded out of it, but several other programs have been funded on it, and the programs use the annual earnings from that quasi-endowment. The Alaska Housing Capital Corporation count is $22 million. That's money that comes from the Amaretta Hess settlement. And you have a capital income fund. Community Assistance Fund has $60 million remaining in it. Without additional deposits, that would be a $20 million payout in fiscal year 19. The Vessel Replacement Fund, which is where we, for the recent Tustamina replacement, that fund was available. After taking that funding, there's still $22 million left in that. And there's other smaller funds. And the School Trust Fund has $623 million in it. It has a very kind of old endowment structure for the payout. It pays out only earnings from, you know, the prior year, and versus a more POMV payout. And there's some legislation in place that would change that to be a more modern POMV payout, which would return more on an annual basis than it currently does, and it would be less volatile.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So why are these DGF and yet the permanent fund is UGF? I'm just trying to figure out, because a dividend was made for a specific purpose, but yet now we're making that UGF, but all these in the budget are DGF.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the UGF designation is under the assumption that the earnings reserve is used by the legislature for other than the dividend only. So it you could argue that it's not reclassified yet, and we are arguing that it is with the SB 26 framework on both the House and the Senate side. It is now a unrestricted general fund source.
And a follow-up?
And Wilson, follow-up.
Thank you. So I still don't understand, because we can use any of these funds for anything we want. I mean, we don't. We choose not to. But if we wanted to next year take the $1 billion out of the power cost equalization and just put it in the general fund, I mean, you could do that with any of those. Same thing with the permanent fund earnings. So I just guess I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's that designation difference? Because also in the information, we're now going to make fuel tax that we've been paying. I'm not talking about the one that we have a bill for that's been UGF, now has been determined to be DGF. So there's got to be some kind of maybe checklist that finally says it turns from one side to the other, because I know we never use the dividend, you know, in our numbers as UGF until recently.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's a within the alleged finances Swiss Army knife, there's a nice set of rules about the designation. Alleged finance kind of has the designation pin, but the rule is if the statute designates the funding to a particular purpose, it is designated. But you are absolutely correct. Any of these can be used for any purpose or could be reverted into the general fund. And then, so it's a choice to have that designation. And, you know, a policy discussion is, I see two distinctly different pieces of designated general fund. One that is earned, like ferry revenues, for a particular direct service. I'm buying a fishing license. I'm paying for a particular class at Avtech or at the university. I'm buying a ferry ticket for this schedule. I see that that truly is a designated general fund. You're not going to earn it unless you provide the service. Versus alcohol tax, marijuana tax, recidivism fund, many of the other ones that are, you know, set aside of a particular tax revenue stream. And but both of them are classified as designated. And I think it's a policy discussion on how those should be classified. And we calculated about a $600 million net zero shift would go into unrestricted general fund if you classified all of those pass-through dollars as unrestricted general fund instead of designated general fund.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
I guess that's my point. I mean, we have statute, you know, on most of these, and that's why they were kind of made through the policy, whether the higher education when we did the scholarship program. But I guess I see the permanent fund being the same thing, although maybe right now we may be talking about other than the dividend, but even the dividend itself, you know, is designated in statute. Mm-hmm. And so the amount that's in there, and I guess the reason I'm making the point, Mr. Chairman, is that so many of our spreadsheets that we've had in the past, so when we start looking like we did here on the Capitol, didn't have the permanent fund in it. And now we do, even though we haven't used any of the earnings. And it makes it much harder, I think, for the public to really start doing that comparison, because all of a sudden we've kind of thrown this new, you know, UGF in there that I think most of us would have assumed at least it would have been a DGF until at some point the earnings reserve gets utilized. And I think, again, it's probably a policy call. Maybe we don't need all these funds, because I think it does make it more confusing, because when we borrow out of a DGF, it makes it look like our UGF goes down, when in reality we're still spending the same amount of money, if not more. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Wilson, and that's why in the budgetary process this last year, what we did was we had all the reports in UGF as well as all general funds, so that could be compared and seen. Mm-hmm. So appreciate the distinction. One other thing on the Community Assistance Fund, I believe there was pour over if PCE generate power cost equalization generated over a certain amount. Mm-hmm. Did that transpire, and did money get transferred from mm-hmm. the PCE fund to the Community Assistance Fund?
So, Chair Seaton, there is a provision that if there is sufficient earnings that an appropriation can be made to the Community Assistance Fund for from the power cost equalization as well as for energy assistance. In fiscal year 17, there was sufficient earnings. It would require the legislature to make that appropriation going forward. And it would be, well, kind of as written, it would be expected to be a 19 deposit.
And is the mechanism for that a part of the governor's budget or a supplemental or anything? What is the mechanism for that determination?
When we put forward our budget last year, we did not include community assistance from unrestricted general fund. Had a plan gone through, had a fiscal plan gone through, it was our intention to put it in as a supplemental. So the power cost equalization deposit would be a fiscal year 19 in a structured way would be a fiscal 19 deposit.
And what I'm asking is the structure of the bill that it was created, does that, if there were sufficient earnings in PCE, does that show up in the governor's budget as a allocation or as an appropriation, or do we, are you saying that the legislature has to do that separately?
It could show up in the governor's budget, but we haven't made decisions on the governor's budget going forward yet.
Right, I'm just trying to figure out the mechanism for the, if PCE did, and that's going to be 19, where that mechanism comes forward so that we're all aware of where it's going to appear. We'll talk about that later. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that also, so PCE and higher education funds have the asterisk, and you said that's set up as endowment. So at the end of the year, or when you do the calculation for the PCE, does the earnings of the PCE just roll back into the PCE and we don't see a separation, or where do we see a separation between the endowment fund and the earnings?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there is no distinction other than the calculation of what the balance was at the beginning of fiscal year 17 and what the balance was at the end of fiscal year 17. That is that's the earnings at that time. But there's no corpus, or it's just the total amount of the fund. It all remains in the fund.
Thank you.
Until appropriated.
Just to follow up. So, thank you. You have the asterisk next to the higher education fund. I assume that works the same way. And do the other funds work in a similar fashion, where there's no difference between the earnings and the corpus?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the rest of them are not quasi-endowments. The rest of them are funds from which a appropriation is made. So that Capital Corp... Actually, the capital income fund is their earnings from the Amaretta Hess settlement. The Capital Corp is the parking lot. So where old reapprops went and sat, that's the parking lot, because I mixed them up earlier when I described it. The community assistance fund is one-third of that balance. At the, you know, one-third of the balance the day before the end of the fiscal year is now available on the fiscal year to be deposited. So without additional appropriations, that would mean $20 million. If there was another appropriation, then it would be higher.
Thank you.
Yeah, so.
Just to be clear, Pat, the history of revenue sharing was, you know, a long time ago, $100 million 3 years ago, or I think the governor's first year is $60 million, then it was $50. Then under the bill that passed, the Senate bill that passed, it went to $38 million. Last fiscal year, it was supposed to be $30 million. This fiscal year, we added $8 million in the capital budget, so it remained at $38 million. And you're saying if we don't add in money to the Community Assistance Fund, it would be $20 million next year?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that is correct. So that kind of covers savings, and I wouldn't say that these are savings, but they are certainly fund balances that exist. Now going into revenue, our permanent fund earnings now is our largest source of annual earnings, annual revenue. You see the red line is the normal general fund revenues, our traditional general fund revenues, and you see the permanent fund earnings over the last several years. And these earnings will be, assuming we protect the value of the permanent fund into the future, this will probably be our most robust annual revenue source from here forward and as we go through.
And in the red line, is that revenue after subtracting tax credit for oil? Or is that?
Chair Seaton, that is the revenue. That is the revenue after the revenue reduction credits, but does not subtract from there the cashable credits that were, you know, $600 million in 2015 and, you know, somewhat more in other years.
So then any per barrel credit as well as any expenditure like the cash credit, but that is written off against taxes owed, that's already incorporated.
That shows up in the red line. So again, kind of reiterating that having the CBR balance at $2 billion is prudent for our revenue volatility and to address any issues outside of normal that it was kind of designed for in the first place, but mostly for any kind of disasters. If we have $2 billion in the CBR, that is a prudent level given our size and especially how we use it on the early cash draws in the beginning of the year. And what this graph shows is if we did nothing and we maintained the CBR at $2 billion and $500 million annually was taken from the earnings reserve instead of getting sustainable revenue over the course of the 10 years, we'd have $5 billion less in the earnings reserve, and it would produce 250 less annually. So that's if we started it in 2020 after we started using the ERA, after we ran out of the CBR. So you can see how it erodes the value of the permanent fund, but you can also see how it will generate less revenue, increase in the need for other revenue sources in the future.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Pat, last year we had back and forth about this revenue cap feature of the Senate and the House permanent fund bill, which was debatable, and those resulted in, I would say, relatively small sort of failure rates. How much money – will you still have enough money in the earnings reserve, the spendable part of the permanent fund, or will it crash and will you run out, right, depending on stock market volatility mm-hmm. and those things? But if you took out an extra $500 million in addition every year, I mean, this doesn't look so awful. The permanent fund is growing, but the chance that what's left in the earnings reserve will fail, that you won't actually have it because of stock market fluctuations, that just goes up massively with a $500 million extra draw. That's the part that's not in this chart. Is that – am I misstating that, or is that correct?
No, through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. It's This assumes straight line, you know, 6.5 or 6.95 every year increases. This does not bake in any of the volatility. We will get to the volatility here in just a minute. So in just a minute, right here we are. So I'm on page 18. So This is looking at the revenue stream. The revenue stream under the base case, which again we were using the 6.95 assumption, not the 6.5, but it's It's only going to be marginally different once you get out there 2 or 3 years. The but then we transpose with that the actual returns from fiscal year 07 to fiscal year 15. And you can see that just base case scenario, you would have $2.7 billion in revenue by 2027 if everything goes along and you get steady state returns all the way through, versus if we have the same experience we did 2007 to 2015, then we would have a total of, you know, just over $2.1 billion. That's a $600 million difference in annual revenue under one earnings assumption versus kind of what most people would say is kind of a negative earnings assumption. It's unlikely it's going to happen, but it did. So it's not impossible to happen. And we would be very tight on earnings reserve under this scenario. And if you were drawing any extra, if you're overdrawing, you'd probably run into real troubles with the earnings reserve.
Good thing, and I wanted to recognize Representative Tarr has joined us.
So there are some scenarios in your packet. And let's see if I can get to full screen here. Yeah. Got it. So this is a really nice screen. So this is a look at under various different assumptions. So we're looking at the 6.5% annual return, the planned permanent fund value with the 5.5 dropping to 5% lagging average. You see you would have a planned ending balance of $76 billion in the permanent fund. The you can see the planned draw amount at that goes from $2.7 billion to $3.4 billion. This is using the House SB 26 version. Of that planned draw, how much, you can see the next line, how much goes to general fund revenue versus the dividend. And then how much our remaining deficit is. So we're pretty much steady state in the near term, 800, 700, dropping down to 311 million in terms of deficits. Again, this is under that kind of 18 service level forecast. You have, so there's more detail. Now you add in motor fuels tax and the royalty that is part of the SB 26 calculation. Now your remaining deficit has dropped down to a slightly smaller amount. You're down to $265 million in the out years. If you were going to fund that with the earnings reserve, the remaining deficit, you would have, instead of in 2019 a 4.3% draw, you'd have a 5.6% draw. So that 4.3% draw is the effective draw because it's 5.25% of the lagging, of the first five of the lagging six-year average. So you're taking 5.25% of a smaller base. So the effective draw on that value is 4.3. If you made up the difference with earnings reserve, that would be a 5.6% draw. Definitely not sustainable in endowment terms. And then you can see the ERA balance remains. The House bill, if we add in House Bill 4001, in the first year we get half the revenue. we drop down, let's say, again, that you used the earnings reserve to cover the difference. Now you're at 5.3. Again, not sustainable. And you can see both under the various draws, instead of having $76 billion at the 10-year time frame, under using having no new revenue, you'd have $69 billion, you know, $7 billion less. And even under not using any, this assumes no use of the CBR, you'd be down to $72 billion. But your ERA balance remains strong, and you can see the dividend calculation over time. Now, if we walk to scenario,
the next scenario, mm-hmm. Thompson has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Pitney. Just out of curiosity, do any of OMB's projections assume any budget reductions at all? Or is it just the percentage you're showing as mm-hmm. increased budgets to cover deficit?
So through the chair, Representative Thompson, this is just using the steady state 2018 and kind of the known increases for retirement and so forth, tax credits, and also just a 2.5% inflation. So it doesn't but it does only have 2.25%. So if we don't do something significant with health care costs in terms of bringing them down, there'd be no way to meet that projection and the 2.5%. And, you know, if you do anything with schools. But it does not bake in additional reductions on top of the 44% so far.
Representative Thompson.
So if we did have additional budget reductions in the future, it would have an effect on this entire graph.
Right. Through the chair, yes, that's true.
Is the 0.25% inflation proofing for the permanent fund in here or not?
Royalty.
No, in the House plan, we had 0.25% inflation proofing.
Chair Seaton, I believe that's showing up in your ERA balance. I don't think we've dropped it back into the. I think that 0.25% would add to this ERA balance. So I don't think we've included it. So your ERA, the permanent fund values would be correct all the way through, but the ERA balance will be high.
And would you check that and let us know?
I will.
Any further questions before we go?
Oh. Okay, here we go. I just have to get my buttons right. So under this particular plan, we're using a 29% dividend, so it's a split between the House and the Senate. We are on scenario 2 of the extra packet, scenario 2 of attachment A. So page 2 of attachment A. So and the difference between this version and scenario 1 is the compromise dividend. And you can see there's a higher, a less of a deficit going forward and a higher value on the permanent fund, but the compromise dividend, of course, is lower. It's at the end of the time period, it's a $1,400 dividend versus scenario 1, which was almost a $1,600 dividend in the 10-year time frame.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
On the ERA balance, why does it go down so significantly between 2018 and 2019? On that line. And then pretty much after that, it stays...
Yeah.
Pretty stable.
Yeah. Under this compromise version with the 29% dividend, it assumes the 4x. There's a what we term as a 4x draw limit. So if the ERA exceeds 4x the draw, So the draw is 2.7 million, billion. If the ERA balance exceeds four times that draw limit at the end of the year, the remainder gets put into the corpus of the permanent fund. So that's the 15 to the 10, is the implementation of the four times draw.
So follow up?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So then that will actually lower, with that provision in there, that would actually lower our ability in the future as far as how much money would be available, not just for dividends, mm-hmm. but also for draw, because once we put it back in the corpus, it's protected.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if you assume to spend the earnings reserve as a savings account versus using the structured draw of the 5.5%, then that provision would limit the amount of money you would have to use it just in an ad hoc way. But as modeled, what that does, that is the permanent fund protection, in that it preserves what is over and above a necessary buffer of four times, essentially 4 years of draw, that goes back into the corpus.
Thank you.
Further question? So, Brittany, on the line of just above there, the 0% draw for 18, that's because we didn't take any money out on a structured draw of the permanent fund. We use the constitutional budget reserve for funding the 18 budget. And so a 0% draw, and then it goes to 5.4 next year.
That is correct. I mean, we could probably put in the percent that was used for the permanent fund dividend, I suppose. It would be more. Because we did have $760 million come out. So.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, Pat, if I missed it. On that 29% dividend, is that based on the Senate's plan, or where did that 29% dividend come from?
So, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's just right exactly between 25% and 33%.
Got it.
It's a compromise. So this particular graph shows it under the 25% dividend. And there's...
So we're looking at page 3.
We're looking at page 3, attachment A. And the important piece here is that this is under the Senate version, which with a 25% dividend, but... There are two different provisions in Senate Bill 26. One provision in the Senate is a offset dollar for dollar what you draw from the earnings reserve at $1.2 billion in petroleum revenue, where the House version is $1.4 billion increasing with inflation. And so you see on this one, if you look here at the ending deficit without any, with only motor fuels as the revenue source, you have 523. But going back to scenario two, back one page, we have the same issue here as 682 because the dividend is higher. But now let's go back one more, and it's actually a lesser deficit under the House plan with a higher dividend because of that $1.4 billion provision dollar offset versus the $1.2 billion offset. So it's kind of what I would say is counterintuitive as we were looking through these various scenarios. But it's an important, you know, as that SB 26 compromise comes together, I think that's that $1.2 billion provision versus the $1.4 billion provision is going to be an important discussion in your compromise. And this is this. Oops, sorry. This last version is what happens if we have that market crash. The fiscal year 07 to fiscal year 15 returns. And without any revenue, we're at a billion. And with revenue, we're at 700 million. And you can see that we have 2 years of no earnings reserve available. And that's where we would definitely want to have the CBR in place and available under that.
So is that no earnings reserve after structured draw, or is that
There is some amount of structured draw, but not. It assumes that you pay dividends first, and then there's some amount that goes towards. You can see the plan draw, the general fund revenue, the base debit, the actual draw. There is some amount of funds available in each of the year because of the actual earnings, but not enough to cover both.
And maybe that is more information, because as you go down the line longer, then in 2023 you have a pretty big gain, and then excuse me, then 2024, I mean, those are pretty big swings. Mm-hmm. But that's coming off of zeros, so I don't know why we would end up with 2 years of zero and then all of a sudden a pretty substantial amount. Maybe that's because the government's not getting anything and neither are the people. So I'll make everybody happy.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the earnings comes off of that permanent fund value. So you're coming across here. So the permanent fund value drops substantially, and the earnings are not enough to cover both pieces, so you've completely used the earnings reserve. And then you again gain, you have market gains, so your permanent fund value is increasing. And this is the experience of that 2007 to 2015, but it's just the experience now using the funds going forward.
So in other words, in some of these years we have fairly large losses, and other years we have fairly large gains. Mm-hmm. So that's
offset.
Not the everything is beautiful and 6.5% is our actual income every year. So is that
correct?
I want to make sure everybody mm-hmm. understands that the difference between this and the other was the others are based on a level 6.5% investment earnings every single year, and this one is based on our actual average, or not average, our actual returns for the last 10 years applied against these years.
And you can see on the if you see the in this column or row on the draw in these middle years, you have 2.1 billion, but if you go back to these others, you have 2.1 growing to 2.3 billion, and 2.1 growing to 2.2. So you have, you're drawing less because your value is less.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So two questions on that. So if the obviously the diversification of the permanent fund is different now than it was at the time. I mean, I don't know if this is possible, but is there a mechanism, and maybe it's a question for the permanent fund, to understand how things, if we're going to use kind of historical average to look at it, we would have to adjust for the fact that we have now invested different than we did at those particular time frames from which we had the substantial loss. Are we able to go back and kind of make an estimate of what the difference in loss would have been if we had had it structured more like or invested more like the way that we have it now?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that definitely would be a permanent fund corporation investment question, and I won't venture to
not a problem. Don't feel forced to answer that. That's why if that's the question for them, I can ask them. Okay. But one other follow up, Mr. Chair. So if the idea is to use historical for the permanent fund, which I understand. I mean, you're trying to kind of give a here's what could happen. Should we then go back and look at the historical averages or costs of oil during that time frame? I mean, because that's also, so we're going to keep one at an estimate based on what revenue has stated. The other one, in this particular case, we're going to use the historical. If we were to apply historical in both those situations, would we also, I mean, I think that's what's really difficult about the estimating going forward is if we were to apply historical, I think it wouldn't look as, the ERA would look terrible, but I think we'd see other areas that might look different as well, including the remaining deficit, et cetera. Is that the?
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's hard in scenarios to introduce many changes, but I think what you're saying is if we had $140 oil in this time period, we wouldn't even need the ERA because, you know, other provisions would protect it, and that's absolutely true. It's a bit of, you know, it's a stress test, and what is how will it stress it, and knowing even under a $320 million modest broad-based tax, you know, under kind of a worst case market condition, which I also agree it's probably less likely that would happen again in that same way. There still is risk. This is, you know, we're not raising so much revenue that we're ensuring ourselves out of all risk capability, all market risks that we're facing. Do we think this is going to happen? In all of our Monte Carlo simulations, it never got this bad.
Thank you. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Recognizing that, I guess that's probably the challenge is that you can never get enough examples to really stress it. But I mean, recognizing that this, let's just take this. Let's use this and say this is worst-case scenario. And you know, you've got HB 4001 on there. Would it not be prudent then to also have a discussion or facilitate a conversation about the other side of things? All right, let's say that the legislature could go forward and we were to generate additional revenue in 4001. We're still far and above away from being able to make to fill that deficit hole if we were to be in this, you know, situation as you have ahead. Should we not look at what structure or what cuts we should do or something related to the size of government during that time frame and kind of give a viewpoint of what to expect if the worst case scenario were to happen, if we were to put some sort of revenues in place, that we still have to have a conversation about what government looks like in terms of the size and the scope and this 2% or whatnot growth that is even showed on there is probably something that wouldn't be sustainable even in these situations.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, when we gave a similar presentation to the Senate, they asked for, if you put a $200 million reduction, government reduction in as a scenario, and so we've modeled that, and we can share that information.
Thank you.
And just to be clear, we did the proposal that went out of the House, passed the House, and went over, did have stress tests, the same stress test on it, and it didn't fail. So just to be clear, putting on the record that stress test doesn't necessarily produce failure if the system is robust enough.
Moving back to the PowerPoint presentation, this is just a quick summary about the tax proposal 4001, but since this was a gap analysis, I won't spend a lot of time on that other than it's, you know, 1.5% tax on wages. It's capped at $2,200, growing with inflation or twice the dividend, whichever one is higher. Under a $2,200 cap, that's, you would not be paying at the cap until you reached $147,000. You can see up through, you know, 70 until you get to $75,000 a year in wages, you don't have a net tax burden. And then the maximum tax burden you have after counting the permanent fund dividend is $1,100. Would still leave the state at the lowest per capita broad-based tax burden. The ones below here are largely alcohol and tobacco, and that the other one's for Alaska. And with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you. And just to be clear, page 20, the statement that out-of-state residents will pay the highest rate because they do not receive PFDs, and we're not really saying that they're going to pay the highest rate because it's a flat rate. They will just not receive compensation from the state in a PFD. I think that we want to make sure that we're not projecting an image that we are having a separate higher rate for non-residents, because that's not the way that 4001. So I would hope that in future presentations you change the wording of that so it's, so people don't think that we've done something we haven't.
Thank you. I will.
Representative Guttenberg, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On going back to 21, which is always an interesting slide, if you put the dividend in there, would it be accurate to say that on this slide, if you just put a $1,000 dividend in there, that it would be flat at zero? I mean, if you offset all the taxes that the state pays and add in the dividend, because it looks like you're at about $1,000. If you put a $1,000 dividend, it would be a net zero.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes.
Okay, so without that, it would even be below. Without the proposed tax cap, we're below. We're in the positive on the zero side. Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the other handout, the spreadsheet that you gave us on unrestricted general fund budgets, FY 2013 to 2018. Why are we using management plan versus actuals? I mean, we're going all the way back to 2013. A budget is basically the most that you can spend, not the least amount you can spend. So why would we not, as far as we could, have put actuals in here so that we really know what's being spent?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we can provide that information. This is has been a traditional view, but we can provide actuals through 16, and we're in the process of finalizing the 17 right now.
So. And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And where do supplementals go? So if you were to give us actuals and just use, you know, 2016 as the last actuals, so if we pass a supplemental, does the 2000, you know, does the year that it actually was spent in, not necessarily the year that we approve it, do you go back and add those amounts in so that, I guess the easiest one is for corrections. This is a $10 million. So we, in a supplemental, gave $10 million, but it was actually spent the previous year. So do you go back and put those in those years so we have a better picture of what was spent? Or where do they go?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if we look at 17 actuals for corrections, and because that $10 million was a DGF source, and we looked at that, it would be shown in corrections in fiscal year 17 if we did fiscal year 17 actuals, because it got spent in fiscal year 17. It came out, it was appropriated when we were finalizing the fiscal year 18 budget, but because it was a supplemental, it was effective in 17 and it was spent in 17.
Perfect. And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And so how often do you look at the vacancies in each of the areas? Because it seems like in the public that's a huge issue, whether or not, you know, we have a lot of unfunded positions, because sometimes there's, you know, cuts to a set amount and then the departments have to go back and do that. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, last year that the governor, I thought, did something like if a position had been vacant for like 6 months, they were going back and deleting those out. So you would have some of that accuracy. But how often does the administration look to see, you know, when maybe you just can't fill that position any longer and update those PCNs?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have two kind of we have two times where it actually gets updated in the budget process. One time is at management plan, and then the second time is at the governor's budget request. And so both of those actually happen in this fall time frame. And the management plan represents the fiscal year 18 that we're operating in, and then the governor's is plan changes for fiscal year 19. So the management plan for fiscal year 18 represents what we expect the positions to be through the current fiscal year. Then when we go to the governor's budget, it was what we expect positions to be when we go into fiscal year 19.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And you may or may not be able to answer. Do you know if it's the intent of the governor to, again, basically do a six-month sweep of any PCNs, unless I think there was a caveat where it was something that was still necessary and maybe had really specialized criteria, and sometimes they do stay open. But is that something, and maybe you've done it every year, and I just caught that last mm-hmm. year, but is that pretty much the intent again this year? To take the same look?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're looking at it all the time. we started 2.5, 3 years ago at a year. Then we moved to 6 months, and now we're monitoring at 3 months. But you can imagine at 3 months there's a lot more factors. But we are actively addressing vacancies that linger. And we question them at those two periods at up to 3 months. But we've really narrowed the scope of the positions that are out there.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And if I'm getting off track, feel free to stop me. But I thanks. So also there was some provisions that the governor had put in the budget where he was looking more seriously at travel and how many positions should be filled if they were attritioned out. Are there any of those restrictions still in place where there was a hiring freeze for a while, travel was being looked at very carefully? Are those all still in effect?
Through Chair Representative Wilson, those are in effect. We have, rather than cycling up to the governor's office, all of those are restricted at the commissioner level. So it's not at the it's not at at an office level or a division level, but all of it comes through at the commissioner's level.
And one last question.
Representative Wilson.
And if we could just get a list of it, if it's something besides just travel and new hires, if there's, you know, other on the agency level that has been asked of that we could know trying to keep our costs down, that would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick follow-up on Representative Wilson's line of questioning, Pat. The revenue director, Mr. Alper, was here a couple of weeks ago and presented in his presentation that there are, in fact, 2,500 less actual people working for the state than there were several years ago. Does that figure ring a bell to you? We're not talking about positions. We're talking about actual people that are no longer working for the state of Alaska. Are you comfortable with that figure?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's very close. I usually look at it on a monthly basis, and I think it's up to 2,600. I have not looked at it this month yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go to page 20, please, Pat?
Yeah.
So I totally understand the governor's trying to build some sort of compromise he thinks everybody will agree with. Here's the part that I think you know bothers me the most about this proposal. Just to understand, is it $150,000 of income, people who make $150,000 and more, where additional income they make, whether it's $1 million, $2 million, $10 million a year, that's where they pay no tax, as it's above $150,000? Or is that just a rough estimation?
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, that's correct.
A rough estimation.
Well, 147,000.
Okay, thank you. And through the chair,
Representative Gehr.
And I think so. 1.5% tax up to $147,000 of income, and then zero tax for anybody who makes more than that above the $147,000. I think Mr. Alper testified that somebody who makes $1 million a year would, under this system, pay 1/6 the total tax rate as a middle or a low-income person. Do you have any different numbers than that?
Through the chair, no, I don't.
Okay. And through the chair. Not going to ask a lot of questions on that. I don't think I could. It's not going to be very easy to sell me on a tax rate that's lower for wealthy people than for middle and low income people. Just leave it at that. The other problem, and I understand why you're not doing it. I'm not saying it's wrong, but this doesn't tax investment income, right? So if you're a very wealthy person and you're making your money off stock market dividends or capital gains, those people are also paying zero, correct, under this proposal?
Through the chair, correct.
So,
in Representative Gehr,
yeah,
we will have 4001 before tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is, the answer from maybe it was Commissioner Fisher, I can't remember, and I don't want to mangle it, but you had a slide before that said if you really want to go away towards dealing with this budget cap, you need to raise about $600 million, as I recall. So, and this raises $325 million, roughly. So I don't know how I go to my constituents and say if we pass this, you know your taxes are going to be raised again. So what did you mean by you should raise $600 million? I don't want to put any words in your mouth.
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, if you want to cover the gap, kind of the steady state gap of $600 million and through revenue, then that's the prudent amount. If your desire is to stress the budget to find additional savings, then something less than $600 million is required. But if you wanted to address the full gap, looking at a revenue target of $600 million is a prudent level. It also makes provides the ability to maintain your CBR and probably in 6 to 8 years begin returning funding back to the CBR, but an insurance policy against overdrawing the ERA. But other people may want to say that 600 may not be a revenue target, but we want to reduce spending. So the 320 is something in the middle of that. Again, we're looking at a way to provide fiscal certainty, connect the economy to the state services received, get significant fiscal certainty. But we will continue to have the question of reduced spending or increased revenue as we go forward.
Finally, through the chair.
Representative Gehr.
Thank you. Page 21, Pat, just one question there, and maybe you'll have to get back to us. I'm not proposing this, but let's say we reach that revenue amount that you mentioned, the $600 million. Can you tell by looking at this, would that leave us at the second lowest overall tax burden, or would that be something you'd have to get back to us on?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, would be the second lowest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for the presentation, and I believe you have a few things that we noted that you would get more information back to the committee. If you didn't get those down, I think our staff was writing those questions up. And so that is our presentation for today, and we will next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, November 8th at 1 o'clock, starting here. And so we will see everybody tomorrow. There's nothing further to come before the committee. Will be adjourned at 3:10.
And that's 1 o'clock.